This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Edward J. Larson, has written extensively about evolution and the continuing debate over science and religion. He won the 1998 Pulitzer Prize for History for his book about the Scopes Trial, called Summer for the Gods. His latest book is called Evolution, The Remarkable History of a Scientific Theory. Larson is a professor of science history and science law at the University of Georgia. The teaching of evolution remains controversial in some parts of the country. A court case now underway in Dover, Pennsylvania, is challenging a recent school board decision mandating that teachers who teach evolution also read a four-paragraph statement that says evolution is a theory, not a fact. The statement offers intelligent design as an alternative explanation of the origin of life. I spoke with Edward J. Larson about some of the challenges over the decades that have been mounted to the teaching of evolution. Let's talk a little bit about the climate that led to the Scopes trial. And you describe how in 1925, Billy Sunday, who was then the nation's best-known Protestant evangelist, did a series of revival meetings in Tennessee. And among the things he said was this: many a minister today has lost his vision. He's standing up in the pulpit preaching tommy rot to the people, that we came from protoplasm instead of being born of God Almighty, instead of being created of the Lord. I don't believe the old bastard theory of evolution. I believe I am just as God made me. Now these revival meetings that he was leading in Tennessee coincided with the Tennessee State Senate considering legislation banning public schools from teaching human evolution. And this legislation was rejected, but after Billy Sunday attracted such big crowds, the Senate reversed itself. So this led to the nation's first anti-evolution law. What did the law say?
The Tennessee anti-evolution law was really quite simple. It was only a couple lines long. It said that public school teachers in Tennessee could not teach the theory of human evolution in so much as it denied the divine theory of creation, and it made it a misdemeanor subject to a fine of $100 to $500 for any teacher who violated the law.
So the teachers would be individually fined.
The teacher would be individually fined for violating the law. It made it illegal for those teachers to teach the law. Now, interestingly, the main proponent of these laws nationally, William Jennings Bryan, the three-time candidate for president and the fundamentalist religious leader, he thought that was trouble. He thought that would just create martyrs. What his goal was that the state should simply pass a law barring the teaching of evolution. And then any teacher who violated that law would look like an ungrateful public employee. This was the type of law that he had campaigned for throughout the country. It wasn't a Tennessee issue. It was a national issue.
So after the Tennessee legislature passed this law saying that teachers who taught evolution would be fined, the ACLU put out a call that any teacher who was willing to challenge this law would be represented through the ACLU. And John Scopes volunteered for that position, and thus the Scopes trial. I'd like you to talk about the different sides in this trial and their approach to making their case. Let's start with William Jennings Bryan, who was the prosecutor. What were some of his key scientific and religious arguments against the teaching of evolution?
From the very beginning, the Scopes trial was a show trial. It was orchestrated by the American Civil Liberties Union to challenge the Tennessee anti-evolution law, which in itself was the result of a national crusade by William Jennings Bryan. Now, he wasn't a local prosecutor. He didn't even live in Tennessee. But when Dayton, Tennessee decided to test this law in court, to take up the ACLU challenge, William Jennings Bryan volunteered as a co-prosecutor, as it were, with the local prosecutor, to prosecute Scopes, but he made a point that he wasn't trying to prosecute Scopes. He didn't care whether Scopes was fined or not. Indeed, he volunteered to pay the fine. What he wanted to do was go to Tennessee and defend the law, defend a restriction against teaching the theory of human evolution in public schools. And he was afraid that that concept would be ridiculed and attacked by the ACLU and in the lawsuits as a violation of academic freedom. So he went with a number of ideas. One point that he made continually was this law was passed by a popular majority. And public schools should be run by the local people. So if the state of Tennessee is supporting public schools and state taxpayers are, they should decide what's taught in the curriculum. That was his main argument for strictly defending the law. But then reaching beyond that, he made arguments that evolutionary thinking led to bad behavior. As he put it, if you teach school kids that they descended from monkeys, then they'll act like monkeys. And it wasn't just in a small sense of acting like monkeys. He brought in eugenics. He brought in survival of the fittest for leading to World War I. He brought in the robber barons justifying capitalism, laissez-faire capitalism, through Darwinian mechanisms. All these issues he had opposed as a politician, he saw them rooted in evolutionary thinking, and so he brought these social concerns to Darwinian teaching to the fore. That was his public argument of why the public is justified for restricting this theory.
Did he make religious arguments against evolution?
Bryan certainly thought that evolutionary belief, evolutionary naturalism, Darwinism, undermined religious belief because it made God not the creator of humans. To put it more graphically, he said, what makes humans special is, as the Bible says, humans are created in God's image. Well, if they've simply descended from lower forms of animals, they're not special in that way. And therefore, that they're not God's special creation. That would undermine their religious beliefs. And for him, religion was the base of social morality. So for Bryan, he could never separate social morality and the public good from religion because they were all linked together. You undermine one, you undermine the whole.
Was this problem just with the teaching of human evolution? Could you teach, say, the evolution of fish and animals, but just not human evolution?
Bryan's sole concern was with human evolution. Indeed, he looked at the Genesis account when asked about it on the witness stand in Dayton, Tennessee, at the Scopes trial. He was asked, was the world created in 6 days? And he replied, not 6 literal days, though each of those days in Genesis symbolized vast ages of geologic time. And in his private writings, he had said, I don't care if the animals had all evolved and the plants have all evolved. What he cared about was humans. And there, he claimed, the Bible was much more specific. It talked about God directly creating humans in God's image. That was the issue that he was fighting for. That was the issue on which he would take his stand.
Now, at the Scopes trial, the defense attorney, Clarence Darrow, wasn't allowed to call as witnesses scientists or liberal theologians who would support evolution. Why not?
Originally, the trial had been billed by both sides as literally a show trial, a public debate, where both sides would discuss the idea and theory of evolution, its pros and its cons, and it sounded like both sides would proceed down that route. Well, going down that route, the defense, led by Clarence Darrow, assembled a large band of scientific experts and theologians who were going to come in and testify that evolution was a widely accepted concept, and the theologians would testify that it did not necessarily conflict with a liberal reading of the Bible and of a deep religious belief. The problem for Bryan was he wasn't able to find experts to defend his side. He couldn't find scientists who would attack the theory of evolution and defend the idea of the special creation of humans. And the only theologians he could find were really fundamentalist evangelists rather than educated theologians. And so it looked like if Bryan and the prosecution proceeded down that route, that they would be bested by Darrow. So they changed their strategy just before trial and instead sought a narrow trial where the only issue would be, did Scopes violate the law? And if he violated the law, then he should be convicted and leave it to the appellate court to decide whether the law itself was constitutional or not constitutional.
Well, I guess the judge sided with Bryan on this, and he didn't allow Clarence Darrow to call scientists and theologians as witnesses. So instead, what Darrow did was he called Brian as a witness. So what are some of the questions that Darrow asked Brian?
Well, first, we got to realize what Brian thought he'd be asked. Brian, of course, thought he'd be asked about the theory of evolution and about the divine story of creation. And Brian was more than ready. I mean, he was a stump speaker, but he usually spoke from prepared addresses, but he had memorized them. And so he thought he was going to get questions about evolution. And those he had said answers to, answers that while they might not appeal to a scientist, certainly would have resonated with the general public. Clarence Darrow took it differently. I mean, if you're a lawyer, you know you never ask a witness a question unless you know the answer is going to help you. It's just a rule of thumb for lawyers. And Clarence Darrow was the best trial lawyer we ever had, and he wasn't going to break that rule. And so instead, what he asked, and this caught Brian totally off guard, he asked him about a lot of other miracles from the Bible, from Genesis. Issues like, did Joshua lengthen the day by making the sun stand still? Well, under the Copernican theory, it's got to be the earth that stands still and not the sun, which Brian noted in his response. Or did Jonah live inside the whale for 3 days? Or where did Cain get his wife if he was one of the first people? There hadn't been any other people talked about. And Darrow knew that there were no good answers to them. You either got to swallow hard and say, yes, yes, the sun did stand still, or Jonah lived inside the whale for 3 days, or deny them and say, no, they're sort of lessons, they're moral lessons. And he knew that either way he had Brian, because if Brian denied them, then his obvious point of it was, well, if you're interpreting those stories, well, why can't you interpret the account of creation in Genesis? But if Brian did say he accepted them, well, then the general public would ridicule Brian's whole belief system and realize that it had no place in science education. Either way, Clarence Darrow won.
So what did Brian respond?
He tried both approaches. Sometimes he sort of equivocated, and he pointed out that some of the stories could be interpreted. He pointed out that he didn't believe the earth was created in 6 literal days, but that each day represented a vast geological period. But on other times, he hung firm, and when pressed, when he was pressed about Jonah inside the whale, he said, it could have happened. God could have chosen to do it that way. And then Darrow kept pressing and says, but did he do it that way? And finally he just hunkered down and said, yes, I believe in miracles, and I can believe God can intervene in nature. And for me, one miracle is easy to believe as another. Now, Darrow immediately commented back, for me, it's just as hard to believe those miracles, one miracle and another. And that really captured the difference between the two men. It was a very telling moment. The other sort of comical moment when he tried to laugh off the questions came when Clarence Darrow asked, what about where did Cain get his wife? Brian answered, I leave the agnostics to hunt for her.
So what was the outcome of the trial, and what precedent did it set?
The technical outcome of the trial was that Scopes was convicted and the law was upheld. That was important because it suggested that states and communities could limit evolutionary teaching, and many of them began doing so. After the Tennessee law was upheld, several other states and many local school districts imposed restrictions on evolutionary teaching, and they stood for 30 years. But on another sense, the defense won, because they had ridiculed the ideas of William Jennings Bryan, ridiculed not with Bryan's core constituency, but with the larger general public. And so both sides claimed victory at Dayton. Now, when I look back, I think they're both right in their claims. Now, it's the funny thing about the Anglo-American legal system. What we do is we have both sides presenting their own ideas, And then a neutral observers are supposed to draw the truth out of those two ideas and reach a conclusion. Well, in this case, we had two of the greatest orators in American history, Clarence Darrow and William Jennings Bryan. And they both effectively communicated their concerns in Dayton. Oh, maybe not well enough to win many converts, but enough to energize their own constituency and make this relatively obscure issue into a fighting issue where people on both sides have viewed this as an issue that really matters. And those words, that voice they gave to this issue, has continued to resonate ever since. And it pops up in countless trials leading right up to the current one in Dover, Pennsylvania.
So what did this Scopes trial do to set the tone for, you know, the next few decades in terms of whether, you know, how evolution would be taught and how the religious view of creation would be taught?
It's important to remember that William Jennings Bryan never argued that the biblical story of creation should be taught in the public schools. He thought that was a religious concept and religion didn't belong in the public schools. What he wanted was that if creation wasn't taught, then at least then the opposite view, then the view that he viewed as irreligious, should not be taught either. And therefore, basically, origins would disappear from the curriculum. And if you look at public school textbooks that were printed between the time of the Scopes trial and the 1960, for example, you see that happening. You see the concept of evolution basically dropping out of the textbooks. And basically, the biology textbooks just didn't cover the issue of origins very extensively. And that process continued because the issue was so controversial. On the other hand, I must say that the Scopes trial became a topic of derision. You had books like Only Yesterday, best-selling books like Only Yesterday, and Broadway plays like Inherit the Wind that ridiculed Bryan's position. So you had a split in America. You had the cultural elite ridiculing the ideas of restricting science education, but the actual practice that was happening in the local schools because of public opposition, you had evolution virtually disappeared.
Was this just in the South that you're talking about?
Actually, that was nationwide. You look at textbooks used throughout the country. This wasn't an issue ever limited just to the South. You had school districts throughout the Midwest, on the West Coast. You had, as a practical matter, people just avoiding the topic of evolution, and that continued right up into the 1960s.
And what changed it in the 60s?
Well, a couple things intervened to change it. One was science education, tied most famously of all things to Sputnik. When the Russians beat America into space, it was a shock to the Americans. And the Congress passed the American Defense Education Act, which, among other things, called for greater federal funding of science textbooks so that we could beef up our science education. And it called upon scientists rather than science educators to write these textbooks. The result in biology was the biological studies curriculum, the BSCS, that came out in the early 1960s. Those textbooks, written by evolutionary biologists and top biologists, reinstituted evolution into the science curriculum. And when those textbooks did it, others did as well. Then there were developments on the legal front. And most particularly, during the late 1940s and early 1950s, the United States Supreme Court reinterpreted and gave new life to the Establishment Clause. Before that time, at the time of the Scopes trial, the Supreme Court had not interpreted the Establishment Clause as applying against state action. It only limited what Congress could do. Well, starting in 1948, and Hugo Black, Justice Hugo Black, was a main actor in this change, the Supreme Court interpreted the Establishment Clause to include state and local actions as long as it was done by government. Well, the result was that because the Establishment Clause hadn't applied against public schools were doing all manner of things, such as school prayer and religious instruction, and limits on the teaching of evolution, that would run afoul of the Establishment Clause if that clause applied to them. Well, once it did, one by one, those public practices were declared unconstitutional. First, religious instruction, then school prayer in 1962, and then in 1967 and 68, the United States Supreme Court struck down the old anti-evolution laws, in particular the Arkansas, but the Arkansas law had been modeled after the Tennessee law. That brought them down. So you have a combination of factors.
Let's skip to 1970 now.
Okay.
You know, so we're in a climate where the law has changed, and you can't ban the teaching of evolution in the schools. And this is the time in 1970 when the Institute for Creation Research, the ICR, is established at Christian Heritage College in San Diego. The college was founded by Tim LaHaye, who's now famous for his series of novels, the Left Behind series. This is a series of novels that says the apocalypse is imminent. And you describe the Institute for Creation Research as opening a second front against evolution. What do you mean by that?
The Institute for Creation Research, which was led by a person named Henry Morris, who had been a professor at Virginia Tech, he developed in the 1960s in a book called Genesis Flood. He tried to pull together scientific evidence that supported the Genesis account of creation, right down letter for letter. That includes that the earth was created in six literal days within the last 10,000 years, that all land animals were created on the sixth day, so that meant humans were created the same time as dinosaurs and lived together for a while, and that one great flood at the time of Noah basically shaped the Earth's features, such as the Grand Canyon. And he came up with a variety of different scientific evidence to support that viewpoint. Now, his book became a classic within the Christian subcommunity among fundamentalist, somewhat among Pentecostals, among some evangelical Christians. He called it creation science. And that gave the creationists something that Brian never had. Brian could just argue against the teaching of evolution. Now they had an alternative hypothesis, an alternative approach. And the goal became, well, if the Supreme Court decision based on the idea of the separation of church and state, says that you can't, for religious reasons, ban the teaching of evolution, okay, we'll teach evolution, but let's balance it. Let's give equal time or balanced treatment to the concept of creation science. That launched a whole second phase in this historical battle.
In 1987, the Supreme Court ruled that the teaching of creation science was unconstitutional. What did the ruling say?
The Supreme Court ruling in 1987, called Edwards versus Aguilar, involved the Louisiana creationism law. And that law had been directly inspired by the Institute for Creation Research and the work of Henry Morris. That law had said you give balanced treatment to the idea of creation science along with evolution science. Similar laws had been passed in two other states and in a scad of local school districts around the country. And what the court did is it looked at those restrictions. It had already ruled 30 years before that you couldn't have religious dogma taught in the public schools. And the Supreme Court ruled that creation science was virtually nothing other than a religious dogma. The key opinion there were written by Lewis Powell. It was a concurring opinion, but what it did was it looked at the teaching of creation science and the work of the Institute for Creation Research, and it concluded that this was nothing less or nothing more than religious dogma, that this was religious apologetics, that this was taking science and not acting like scientists do, where you come up with a hypothesis and test it and find out if nature matches the hypothesis, but rather this was a religious idea that its proponents, like Henry Morris, believed were true, and they simply looked out and they got those ideas from the Bible, from Genesis, and they looked out to nature to find things in nature that confirmed their pre-existing religious views. That, the court ruled, was a religious dogma, and as a religious dogma, it was banned along with other types of religious instruction from being included in the public school classroom.
If you describe creation science as a second front in the fight against the teaching of evolution, or at least the fight against teaching evolution without teaching an alternative, I suppose you could describe intelligent design as the third. Intelligent design was founded by Philip Johnson. Who was he, and how does intelligent design compare with creation science?
Philip Johnson was a professor at Berkeley. He was a law professor. He had gone to Harvard Law School. He attended Harvard Law School, graduated from Harvard Law School, had been a clerk for Chief Justice Warren. But in addition to that background, he was also and is also a deeply religious evangelical Christian. And politically, he's very conservative. He was obsessed with, and he would use almost those terms himself, obsessed with Richard Dawkins' view of evolution, that the Darwinian theory of evolution virtually disproves Christianity and proves that there isn't a God. Now,
this is what he says, Dawkins says. This is the way he interprets
Johnson,
Dawkins.
This is how Johnson interprets Dawkins, but it's a pretty fair interpretation. Richard Dawkins does take that approach, that science disproves God and that evolution disproves God. And I think that Phil Johnson basically has that reading right. Now, there are many scientists who totally disagree with that. There are many leading scientists who say that evolution is totally compatible with Christianity and religion, but Dawkins isn't really part of that crowd. And those were the books and their bestsellers that Phil Johnson picked up when he was on sabbatical one year in England. And he decided that as a lawyer, he could make the counterargument. And that led to his book, Darwin on Trial, where he tried to show the weaknesses in evolutionary thought. Now, Phil Johnson is not necessarily a young earth creationist. He's not necessarily in the same group as Henry Morris in the Institute for Creation Research. But he is an evangelical Christian who deeply believes that God can act in nature. And working with others argues the point that nature reflects God's intelligent design, almost lifting the line from the Bible that the heavens declare the glories of God.
So how does intelligent design, as laid out by Philip Johnson, compare to what was described as creation science?
Intelligent design, broadly interpreted, is simply the concept that nature reflects an intelligent designer. And in this sense, it has a long pedigree in Western thought, going back to the likes of William Paley, who wrote the famous book Natural Theology in 1801, and even back beyond that, going throughout Western thought, especially Christian thought, both in the Catholic and Protestant denominations, that one way we can understand God is through God's creation, and that the wonderful design in nature, the balance in nature, the butterflies and the bees, the design of the eye, the shape of the butterfly's wings, all these examples testify to the fact that there is a God who designed these things, that these things couldn't exist without a designer, and also gives us evidence of the character of God, that God is a loving God who creates a good creation. So that has been a part of the Western sort of religious tradition, separate from any defense of a literal reading of Genesis. And that's the tradition that intelligent design fits into. Not to defend the literal reading of Genesis. No, that can be taken as allegory, as metaphor, as typology, but rather the whole idea of design testifies to a designer and therefore is, in a sense, apologetics because it defends religion.
On what grounds do the proponents of intelligent design argue that that should be taught or referred to at least in the schools. Since this, I mean, after the Supreme Court has said that the teaching of creationism violates the clause saying, violates the amendment saying that there can be no establishment of religion.
That's a very good question, because it's a tightrope that the intelligent design advocates have to walk. And remember, one of their leaders is a Berkeley law professor, and many of the people involved in the movement are very well educated. And they look at this law. The law says you can't teach. You've got the established Supreme Court decisions that the separation of church and state prohibit promoting a religious dogma, religious doctrines, religious instruction in the public schools. So how do we get around it? Well, the way to get around it, this doesn't mean you can't teach alternative scientific ideas, or you can't teach scientific ideas that are critical of the theory of evolution. And so what they see is that, all right, let's teach the controversy. Let's expose students to the gaps in evolutionary theory. Let's stress that evolutionary theory is just that, is just a theory. Now, in part, that mixes up the meaning of what theory means, but for people in the intelligent design movement, the neo-Darwinian synthesis, the technical scientific theory that everything evolved from naturalistic process, they don't buy that. They believe that God, even if there is evolution happening at some level, God intervenes in the process. Well, if they can point to those gaps where you'd need a God to step in, they can open the door to students looking in that direction.
Okay, so intelligent design says that, you know, all of nature is so intricate in its design that there had to be some kind of higher intelligence. And whether you use the word God or not there, that science just isn't adequate to explain creation, which leads us to the current case in Dover, Pennsylvania. And this case mandates, this case is based on a school board that mandated that if evolution is being taught, then teachers must also read a statement that includes this quote: because Darwin's theory is a theory, it continues to be tested as new evidence is discovered. The theory is not a fact. Gaps in the theory exist for which there is no evidence. And the quote goes on to say that, you know, students who are learning about evolution should consider getting out of the library a book called Of Pandas and People. So why don't you describe what you think the larger issue here is in the Dover, Pennsylvania case?
The Dover, Pennsylvania case really raises a couple different issues, and that's what makes it such a complicated case to follow. Indeed, it raises so many issues that even the core intelligent design group, led by a group called the Discovery Institute, based in Seattle, Washington, have backed away from it and pulled their own witnesses out from testifying. That's because the statement was pulled together by people who apparently had a deeply religious motive. And so on one hand, they wanted to raise the intelligent design issues, that there are gaps in the theory of evolution and that it's just a theory, which we've heard before, such as in the case coming out of Cobb County, Georgia, last year. But then they include an alternative. Then they say, in addition to this idea, there's also what they call is the explanation of intelligent design. And if you want to learn about that explanation, go to the library and take out the book Of Pandas and People, of which they put 60 copies or some large number of copies in the library for the students to read. Now, on one hand, that raises the core intelligent design issues, that is, that nature is just too complex to have ever been produced by a purely naturalistic mechanism as envisioned by the neo-Darwinian synthesis. But then it gives content to the opposing idea. And if you looked at that content, you'll see the idea that God created all the different species, and therefore that there isn't common descent, that all the species didn't evolve from a common ancestor. Well, You can, of course, have intelligent design mixed with the idea of common descent. It's called theistic evolution, and that idea has been around ever since the time of Darwin as a version of evolution. You're cutting that out, and you're by pointing out the book of Pandas and People, which has already been ruled in other courts to be a religious book promoting a religious idea. And that's what's made this promulgation by the school board in so much trouble. And that's why the intelligent design people have backed away from it. Not that it's trying to raise issues about evolution, but rather that it's providing an alternative. And then when you look at that alternative, the alternative looks pretty religious.
We've been talking about the teaching of evolution. So finally, why do you think teaching evolution is so important?
I believe that it is important to teach the theory of evolution because that's the concept underlying modern biology. When you think about it, all the great scientific breakthroughs in the world of biology over the past 150 years, be it in medicine, in biotechnology, in ecology, have come from people who take an evolutionary worldview. And if we want our students to learn about evolution so that they can make the next generation of breakthroughs, they can continue to build on this research, build on these developments that has practical value, medical developments, biotechnology, all these areas, they're built on evolutionary concepts. And that's why it's important that it be in our classroom and that our students learn about it.
Ed Larson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on the show. It's been a delight.
Edward J. Larson's latest book is called Evolution, The History of a Remarkable Idea.